Access number 11938, reel 28.
Mr. G. Iston, reel 28. You were describing the action of a patrol, and that patrol was part of a column that had gone out. Is that correct, Mr. Iston?
Yeah, it was part of a company column, which was, as I said, getting towards the end of it. As rum was starting to get round Burrakeen, this column went out under divisional orders, and this tank came to see what was going on, and the carriers chased him, and with their own Bren guns, the tank crew gave up and we sent them back. As the patrol went out that night from the column, there was a foot patrol going out to try and get prisoners. The carriers were going out to try and do a shoot-up of the soft-skinned artillery which was going around to feed Rollam, who were already now on the east side of their box. And I took 2 3-tonners out and turned this Christie tank round facing the direction it was, which was a problem because I had to put the 2 3-tonners in tandem on one corner to slow the tank round. Now, it was a bit unfortunate in the sense that about a month previous, I'd just done 2 days with the REs on the course because the ITIs were getting a bit naughty and they were leaving all sorts of booby traps, like books that you open the flap and the bomb flew out at you, and they had pencils which they were sticking in the ground. As you picked it up, it went off and flew up and your ball bearings flew in your eyes. Another one which I'd just been told about was that in their tanks they had 2 tubes down which they could put explosives to blow up the engine without having to lift the flaps. The engine cord is a very heavy thing on a tank, and these tubes allow them to put a charge down to destroy the engine without having to get in the engine compartment. Now, to get inside the Christie tank, you were going through the cupola and through the turret and climb away down, but there was also a door between the tracks, which was the easiest if you wanted to be in the driving seat. So I got in through this door, through the tank, and got myself in the driving seat. And I was pulling the slow levers back. Better describe it. On a tank, to drive a tank, you have 2 levers, which disengage clutches on the back axle, which means that you can slip one crutch and a clutch, and that track will stand still, and the other track will drive round, so it turns you round. But when you don't have power and you're trying to do it with 2 or 3 tons, you pull them both in. So you disengage both clutches, disengage the gearbox entirely, but you also disengage the clutches. So that frees a lot of the torque which is needed. So I got inside this tank, and the 2 3-tonners, as I said, I had them in tandem to try and turn the tank round in line with the direction. We got it lined up nicely in about the direction we want, and then I stopped them to put 1 3-tonner on each corner, which meant that I had a 3-tonner and I could just see through the 2 3-tonners. And we got going great guns. We had a struggle once to get it into motion, but once we were into motion, we were doing great guns. And suddenly there was this almighty bang. And the first thing, of course, was that somebody put these things down the engine compartment. And then if they'd done that, I wouldn't be listening to anything else. I mean, you don't hear the one that actually hits you or anything like that. But what had happened was that I'd left the door open on the side and it had clashed too. Well, you never heard such a noise. You've got to imagine a tank like a big drum and the clang. Oh, terrific noise it was. I mean, I was already sweating inside this thing because I wasn't too sure what was going to happen or anything. And anyway, the lads were away by this time, and they knew the direction they wanted to be. I think there was an officer with us. I can't remember. I think there was somebody with us to do the navigating, because I was going inside the tank, you see. And anyway, we got back within a reasonable distance of the where the column was lagered for the night. We didn't want to take it in the column exactly. We wanted to park it away just to the side of it, hoping that somebody was coming to pick it up during the daylight. Well, we wanted to park it where the column was going to move to in the morning. So as we were approaching the column, this artillery officer came out to meet us. And we stopped, and I got out. I said, "You've got a bit of nerve, haven't you, coming out to meet the tank like that?" It was an Italian tank. He had a bit of nerve coming out to meet the tank. He said, "Oh, I'm not worried. I've just got 425 pounders training on you." As simple as could be. Anyway, we did eventually get the tank parked up just outside the column. And the following morning, the tank transport unit came out to pick them up. And I got a dog's life off them, because they'd had to come out of the box to pick this tank up. I mean, we'd been out 6 days. and no bother at all. But because they'd had to come out of the box in front of the lines, oh, there was only war on. It was nothing to do with, well, it had something to do with me in a sense, because I said we'd get it back, and if they came and collected it, well, fair enough. But the RAC people really went down my throat as though it was entirely my fault that they had to come outside the box like this tank. And he was taken back, and Christie, he was called a Christie tank, and Christie had developed the suspension. In fact, I believe it's still in use today, the Christie suspension for track laying vehicles, and they wanted it back so they could have a good look through it. And it was complete, you see. There was nothing damaged. Well, they had put a shot through the petrol pump. We found that out afterwards, because we wondered why it wouldn't start. And we had a look round the following day in daylight, and there was a shot through the petrol pump, so that's really why it wouldn't start.
How long, on average, was a column out?
6 days.
And you went to a spot, and you went that to more or less your base?
No. You went to a spot through the day and lagered, and there'd be a bit of a recce with the carriers just to get the lay of the land. And at dusk, you moved nearer to the lines. You closed the box in.
You must have had a pretty good idea where the German and the Italian lines were.
Oh, yes, because we were out 6 days, and that was our purpose, was to plot where they were. And all the plots went back to division. As I said, we were out every third week. We went out. The 6th Battalion went out every third week. This was in the early days. Later on, it got to be those columns out, two or three columns out. You couldn't do with too many out, because you've got a minefield to get back to, you see. You've got to come in through a minefield. And people out there have got to know that you're out, otherwise you're going to have a shoot-up among yourselves. So you can't do with too many out, really. If we went for a big shoot-up, we would take the one I've described is normally known as a half column, but they were all jock columns. And I think a company was normally a half column. The full column would be two companies, which was classed really as a battalion. Same idea, same type, but doubled up all the way through. You'd have two troops of tank guns, anti-tank, you'd have two troops of Bofors, you'd have four. Or if you're going for a good shoot-up, you might even take 12 guns.
So, with a company, a full column, the aim and objective would be something very specific, would it?
Yes, it would be a good shoot-up for some. Something wanted
to target
up.
Target to go.
Yes. Yes.
When you
No, these columns never went out willy-nilly. There was an action, there was something to do for every column that went out. Every night there was something for the con to do.
Was there something bigger, you had a bigger con?
If there was something bigger and you wanted more guns, obviously the con was bigger. You had more infantry to protect the guns, you had more anti-tank guns to protect the
When you lagered up, was it just a question of some distant point, or did you actually look for a place which was considered a good concealment spot? Or?
The carriers, during the day, when they left the column through the day, they were looking for a place for the night, normally. Sometimes the column commander would go with the carriers and have a look around and see what he could see. They didn't like carriers or any vehicle travelling alone in no man's land. It was two plus. I don't think they ever allowed anybody to go out, any vehicle to go out on its own, unless it was one which had got left behind for some reason. And then, of course, it was on its own because we just hadn't made it with the rest of them. It got lost, maybe in the darkness, one could easily get lost. And the thing to do, really, if you're really lost, is to sit down, because you can go round and round in circles. And the circle can go over towards the enemy lines, can go towards our lines. So, if you knew your stars and you had the timepiece, you could generally find your way home. But of course, you don't have stars every night. When the stars were out on the desert, they were beautiful, but you didn't have stars every night. And in fact, you might have a car machine where you've got no visibility at all. You purely rely on the compass.
Was there, over a period of time, and having had quite a number of columns out, were there good column leaders and bad column leaders that were showing? Were there certain officers where you'd say, oh my goodness, we're going with him, as against others saying, well, he's all right?
I don't think so, because everybody had a different attitude, I suppose. For instance, I spent quite a lot of time with Freddie Cole, Captain Cole, with the carrier platoon commander. And he was, to put it bluntly, he was mad. He saw no danger at all. And to go with him, you knew you were taking a chance, but he was doing the job. So he went with him. He had a job to do, and he did his job. It was seldom that he didn't do what he set out to do when he went. So I don't think this good and bad thing came into it, really. I don't think there's anybody we're frightened to go with. I must admit I wasn't too keen on going on battalion one because it was too big. Obviously any plane seeing something as big as that, it's going to have a go at it. I mean, it's not really going to be planes, it's going to be shells as well. So I wasn't too happy about the big one. But there again, it was something that had to be done. You were going out for a shoot. And you were taking the guns out for a shoot. And it was a thing that wanted doing. They would give us some idea of what we were going for before we set off. Well, no, not before we set off, but while we're out, they'll give you some idea. Well, maybe I was privileged, I don't know, but I had a good idea of what else to do.
Was the objective of the comms also to, in effect, command no man's land?
It was, yes.
To keep the Germans well back?
Yes, to keep them in the place.
Did you find that the Germans never, or the Italians or both, never attempted to reciprocate, to push out as many comms as you were pushing out?
Towards the end of April, yes. Towards the end of April, they started creeping towards us. And some of the places which we had gone to regular, on a daily basis, we found that they were now occupied by Germans or Italians. So we had a good idea that something was starting to brew then. But by that time, at the back of the column, apart from the South Africans and the 50 Dave and the Free French, at the back of the column we got various armoured divisions crept in behind us.
Is it the back of the box?
The back of the box, on the east side of the box, the Egyptian side of the box. because, as I explained, the idea was that if to get through the box, if we could hold him on the front, he had to go right down into the desert and cope on the back side of us. And this is what we anticipated him doing. If 50 Dave and the South Africans could hold him on the front, he had to go around. There was no way he was going to come through. And by this time, we'd got a lot of divisions, the 7th Armoured, 22nd Armoured, 23rd Armoured Brigade, Independent, the Guards Brigades, all out on the backside of us, waiting for him to come round the corner. And so there's a big build-up at the back as well as the front.
When you were going out quite regularly, was it spot or a position, a part of the terrain where you felt you were likely to catch someone almost every occasion, you know, a named spot on your map, and you, if we go there, we're likely to catch them?
At the start, yes, because the Germans and the Italians were spent. They were on the edge of their supplies. So at the start, we could go and do our... The no man was ours. No man's land was ours. There was hardly any retaliation at all, except on fixed lines. When we got within their lines, inside their minefield, there was fixed lines. And the night we went off the tank, we were watching our boys having a shoot-up, and we could see all these tracers flying all over the place, and you could hear the 88s, which have a bark of their own. It's like a dump-dump. It's like a double-barreled, the sound of an 88. And you can also hear the whine of the shell. So they were on fixed lines. If anybody went anywhere near, say, a mine went up in the minefield, that was crossed by machine gun fire all the way across. And it would also take the next bay in as well, in case anybody was working around it. So they had a good defensive line. And of course, the thing was to try and creep through the minefield without disturbing anything and getting in their lines, lob a few grenades into their forward trenches and grab one or two and out the same way and back as sharp as ever you could. These prisoners were after an information, mainly, at the start.
You mentioned ridges. What exactly do you mean by a ridge in the desert?
Yes.
Or prominent positions.
A ridge is sort of 15 feet high. On the coast, there's a ridge runs east and west along the coast, which is quite high. I suppose it's something like 200 feet. And that is a real escarpment going down to the coast. And then it's flat on the top. With all the dust and sand blowing around, the desert becomes level. But every now and again, there's a hard patch in the desert, especially in the limestone area, where the sand blows off the top, and you get this ridge about 15 feet, I suppose, at the highest. You could just nicely get a carrier down at the back of one of these ridges, unseen, and they could creep maybe 200 yards and come and look over the top. But ridges, nothing like the things that we've got today. I don't know how I would describe one, quite honestly. But you're talking about a ridge about 15 feet high, higher than the sand below it.
But in that terrain, these presumably became tactical positions.
Oh, yes. I mean, I've explained about the ambulance post. One of these ridges was named Ankle Ridge because there was an ankle, the remains of an ankle on it. The one in front of it was, I've forgotten. Anyway, there was two ridges. The back one was Ankle Ridge because there was the body of the plane left there. Very often, the tracks we knew from the direction, because they are reasonably straight, not dead straight, but reasonably straight. There was the Tricapuso, which ran quite long through Knightsbridge, which was went right along from Tobruk, from City of Irani nearly, right into Tunisia. It was a direct where the camels used to travel. And those various ones, there's one from Bir Hakeim right into Alamein, which is more or less the line of that our front line was. In fact, there is a story of later on at the time of Alamein where there was a group of Bedouins and Senussi on the coast grazing their camels. And when the lions got back there, they walked down no man's land, about 60 of these camels and all the Senussi and everybody with them, walked the full length down the no man's land between the two minefields. And not one hurt. which is amazing. It's hard to believe that this could happen. I mean, who would think that the camels in no man's land didn't belong to one side or the other? But they did. They got through. And the fellow that did this, he actually became the king of the Senussi in the later days.
Can I ask you about the stress upon men who were going out regularly on columns? Did you see any evidence of strain and stress on these columns?
The foot patrols, they certainly showed some signs. And it's hard to believe that men did these things, really. I mean, they went out into these fixed lines and tried to creep underneath the line of fire. I mean, you can see the tracer every fifth bullet, I think it is, or every third bullet, every fifth, I think, is a tracer. But the snag is that the tracer generally falls before the other ones did, so if you were underneath the tracer, you were all right. But they had to creep underneath this, and they got minefields all the way around them to get through before they got into the trenches to get any prisoners that they could get hold of. They would go through one, through the minefield and through the first line of trenches, and go right behind them and throw grenades at the trucks of the vehicles in the sort of three lines behind in the supply areas. It's hard to think that men actually do this. It wasn't my situation. It wasn't part of my duties. My duties were to keep the vehicles going.
Were there some men, to your knowledge, who got a reputation for being particularly skilled at this?
Oh, yes, there were a number of them. Cole, I've already mentioned. Maurice Kirby took a detachment of mortars out one day. And I think he had 48 shells with him, and he got close enough to get 12 or 20 away. And he had a real good burn-up. There was all sorts of trucks burning out of these 12 mortars that he logged over. And this was done really without sights. Maurice led them out to the position which he'd already knew about from the previous day, and lined his mortars up without sights in the dark and fired his mortars, the bombs off, and he had a real good burn-up. There's a story about that one of the New Zealanders was trying to get back to our lines, and he was in among the transport hiding to try and get through the German lines to get back to our own lines, and he got in the 2 days later and explained what a good shoot-up it had been. They'd had a real... real good, though. There was lots of them. Boy Stone, very young lad. He's sort of second commander of the carriers. And, of course, he had a hard taskmaster with Freddie Cole. He did remarkable work. I can't remember a lot of the field men, the foot troops, because they changed so often that... You see, I would go out every 3 weeks, but with a different company every 3 weeks. Now, I might get the same section of carriers. Well, I shouldn't get them this next time, but in 6 weeks, I might get the same section of carriers. But the infantry, I mean, you only got one company every 12 weeks kind of thing. So I didn't really get to know much about the
So your task was to... make sure the vehicles ran off, they broke down, to get them back again. Were there any instances when you felt, you know, it was a bit hairy for yourself, you had something to do and it was a bit difficult?
Well, in the later stages this often happened because the carriers in particular used to heat up and boil. But it wasn't just the water that boiled, the petrol actually boiled. I mean, we didn't mind the water boiling too much. We would try and run them back out of action for a short spell, give them half an hour to cool off. You daren't open them up to put water in for at least half an hour. In fact, if you could lie them low for an hour, all the better. But they couldn't always do that. But the big snag was that the petrol used to boil up as well. So it meant that you were getting no petrol through the carburetors. And then I would go out with another carrier and my toolbox. And they would drop me off. And my favourite tool was a squirt petrol can. A squirt oil can. And there was one type in particular, it was only a small one, which was very good for squirting petrol. And when this thing happened, I used to go out and take the cover off the side, which is, as soon as you did that, you were belted with really stinging hair. So you had to take the cover off and give it a few seconds to let it blow out. Then I would take the air filter off and squirt a couple of squirts of petrol in. And I would tell the driver to start up, and he would turn the starter. And then if we were going out backwards, which we very often did, he would put his foot flat down on his throttle foot, flat down on the throttle, and I kept it going just by squirting petrol in. So very often it went in jerks, but I had to control the amount of petrol that went in, so we got an engine that ran as even as possible. I mean, it could be even, because, I mean, you've got a squirt of petrol, and then you die down, and then another squirt, and so forth. So it couldn't be even, but I had to try and get it as even as possible. And it would back off till it could get somewhere where it could cool off. And this happened on a number of occasions, and very often it happened under fire. In fact, when we were at the Marath, which is much later on in the story, I had a Dodge PU, and they gave me a driver at this stage. Quite a story, this one, actually, but they did give me a driver, and this happened while I was going out under heavy fire, heavy shell fire, and in the finish, my driver refused to take. He said, "I'm not going with him anymore, that's enough." And he went back, and I was left out on my own. I never reported him. That was Marath, and it was a really a bad occasion. But this was the sort of thing that was happening quite regularly. Right. And a number of carriers who were brought out under this situation, they would go in for a shoot-up, you see, and get boiling. And because when they were shooting up, they didn't want to stand still, otherwise they were a target. They were trying to move, and very often they were going broadside, so they went along the line of transport which you're trying to shoot up, which again left them open. I mean, it's much easier if you've got a sloping front and a shell hits you, it's going to bounce off. But if you're on a broadside and you've got a flat front, then a shell hits you and it's going to go stop and go through. So they did get quite regularly far too hot, and I had to go out on a number of occasions from the jock column out onto these things. On one occasion, this was quite late in the situation, Freddie Cole's driver got killed. Well, Freddie got wounded, and his driver got killed. Now, in the carriers, the driver had a seat with a lever, and if you lifted the lever up, you could see over the front of the carrier. If you dropped the lever down, you could look through a slot, a 4-inch by 2-inch slot of glass in the armoured plating. And then your steel helmet on the top sort of protected you, the very top of your head. But on this occasion, the driver, and most of them did, was driving the upright position, and he got shot and died instantly. Freddie Cole was wounded in the same machine gun burst. And Fred, fair play to him, he just put his hand out over the driver's knee, pressed the throttle down, swung the steering wheel, Now, on the carrier, I don't know whether I explained it or not, the steering wheel on the carrier disengages the clutch and also puts a little brake on the same time so that it does the two actions. You've got a steering wheel, you don't have to get underneath for the tiller. Freddie brought it out with his driver dead and him wounded. And he was wounded so badly that at one stage he couldn't go any further, and the carrier started to slow down. And the OP who was out with them, the observation post officer from the RA, the artillery, he got his carrier to go across to him, and he jumped in beside Freddie, pushed him out the way and dragged the driver out. In fact, that officer brought the carrier out the rest of the way. Remarkable forethought on both of these people's side. How the RA officer knew that he was without a driver, but he must have been watching him, because they were getting on very well, these two, Freddie Cole and the OP from the RA. And of course, the thing was, in these later stages, when the box wasn't too far away from the column and the German lines had come right into us, then he could contact his guns in the box and they would shoot from the box.